This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Come together, we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, cause we are birds of a feather.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, author, musician, teacher, Gregory A. Wilson. Just stay there. Stay tuned. Keep going. Tune in. Well, we can all just sit here while this blessed machine decides whether or not it wants to cue up the next bleeping song. No, still not doing it. So Ian, Mr. Forrest, is being so kind, has been so kind, and the other machine's at least relatively fast. It's got a weird keyboard and stuff like that, but it's semi. He said clicking, and it doesn't happen. It semi works. Yeah, I know that's the okay, but you know it ought to work from the from the instruction. At any rate, we want to start with just a little bit of music. But you know what? What we'll do is, before that, I guess I'll do whatever announcements I would have done after the music. So let's see. What will we start with? Yeah, might as well announce next week's show, right? Why not? Next few weeks. Next week, Altered Fluid. The writers group will be here en masse. It'll be about 11 guests in this room, and it's always a lot of fun. It's sort of the Hour of the Wolf version of a reality show, and it's a fascinating thing. What we have basically is people from a writers group. A writers group is a collective of people that go to analyze each other's writing. Somebody submits a story, and then everybody reads the story. They come together in a group and they rip it to shreds. No, they don't rip it to shreds. They can be very supportive, but they do critique it. And if they don't say something negative, they haven't done their job. The idea is to improve the story at hand. Now, I cannot imagine a braver thing to do than to do that in any situation. But let's take that a step further. To be able to do that on the air, that takes all kinds of guts and various body parts that are best left unmentioned. But they do it. This is, I think, actually either our fourth or fifth time out doing this kind of thing. I think it has been pretty successful, and I've been very pleased with it over the years. So the two or three years that we've been doing it. And so this will be the next time. Our reader this time out will be Rajan Khanna, and I have no idea what he's going to read. As a matter of fact, I doubt that the group has yet read the story. Hopefully, but not necessarily, it has been written. It was only determined that he was going to be the reader about a month ago. So we shall see exactly what happens. And then the various people in the group, who are Matthew Kressel and Tempest Bradford and Mercurio Di Rivera and Chris Dykeman, Eugene, the whole gang. You will meet them next week, or if you want, go to my website. There's a link to their bios. That's at ourwolf.com is my website. So that's next week. The week after that is, interestingly, July 4th, and it is at this point an open show. I do not have a guest scheduled. However, I have recently run into, at the KGB bar last Wednesday for their fantastic fiction reading, ran into old friend, not that old, but, Ian, check this out. Primary hard disk drive 1, not found. We're getting, we're not even getting a blue screen Odeth here. We're getting, oh, it's booting up. It's booting up, but you see? That's because I made that remark about the mojo. That's why. I said, look at that. I got on time. I said this off the air, and okay. So I ran into Chris Claremont and Beth Fleischer, his wife. Beth, of course, was editor, I guess, at Berkeley, Ace Books, I don't remember which, I'll have to ask her, but a major editor nowadays, an agent, a literary agent, and he's going to check out, of course I didn't email him, which is what I was supposed to do, but he's going to check out whether that week is free. If he is not free, then it'll be later in the month. So Chris Claremont, for those of you who don't know his name, he wrote for, 20-something years, something called X-Men, Wolverine, that stuff. And he has a new book out, X-Men Forever. So he's looking to promote that, and we will probably say, so, I hear they made a fourth movie of your stuff without crediting you. How did that go? Although he was actually in the third film. He and Stan Lee are in the third film.
Oh, okay. Stan can't do a film. You know, there can't be a film connected to anything that Stan's ever done without him doing a cameo, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. Exactly. And he created X-Men, Stan Lee, but Chris, you know, he then handed it over to Chris.
Yeah.
And Chris wrote it for I don't know how many years, and most of the characters that people have known, at least through the movies, from Mystique to Sabretooth and this and that, and those are all Chris Claremont creations. Yeah. And it was Chris who really gave Wolverine the claws he bears, as it were. So, but also, Chris is just a fun... when I first had him on the air, I hadn't read X-Men or anything like that. I had him on the air because he writes damned good science fiction. Mm-hmm. He wrote a trilogy... Nicole Shea is a, she was one of the first, women space pilots to be written about. There have been many since, but in the 70s or early 80s when that came out, that was fairly revolutionary on his part. And since then, he's also written a trilogy based on Willow that he co-wrote with some guy named George Lucas.
Mm.
Chris gets around.
That guy, yeah.
Yeah, he gets around. He does stuff, but it's always, like, shadowed, you know, by the movie, by Stan Lee, by George Lucas, these people who, well, I shouldn't say that Chris does the work. That's not fair.
But he does a significant portion. I mean, you know, he's a major part of it, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I understand with George Lucas, basically. Yeah. Good night, Ian. I'll see you next week. Yes. Thank you. Remind me. At the end of the show, remember the hard drive. I usually leave it in that damn machine over there, which is, like, over our...
Will do.
Thing. Anyway. So maybe in 2 weeks Chris will be here. If not, he'll be here within a month or two. And in the can, as they say, I have China Mieville and Benjamin Rosenbaum. And these are really cool writers, and I'm extremely pleased. I have a wealth of material, and I have learned a lesson. I'm not booking anything for August because we have, surprise, another fundraising drive in August. I mean, it's been almost 3 weeks or something since we had one. And this last time out, I actually got preempted because they wanted to make more money than I was bringing in. Well, we have a new PD around here. I believe he's currently on the West Coast. And when he comes back, and this was the guy who ran the last thon, right? Raising more money than we've raised in a long time, so it's hard to kick. But this is the guy who preempted me. So I got to go to him and say, okay, you're not going to preempt me, and we're going to make tons of money. That's what's going to have to happen. Okay. So, let's see. The week after that, after July 4th, I will not be here. Simon Lokley will be here. I will be at ReaderCon.
I'll be there, too.
That's right. Yep. That's right. So Greg and I will both be at ReaderCon, and you can all sit and enjoy the dulcet sounds of Simon Lokley. Or, hey, come to ReaderCon. It's great.
It is great.
Yeah, they've got a dead guest of honor and everything. Well, they do.
Every year. That's right.
But this year
they raise the dead on a yearly basis.
But this year, Michael Swanwick is going to be doing an interview.
Right.
With that guest of honor.
Right. Right. Which is not beyond their ability to do, I think. Having seen what the ReaderCon people can do, Eric Van and the rest, wouldn't surprise me.
Oh yeah. Well, and Swanwick.
Yeah. Well, right.
Kat Rambo will be here. She'll from ReaderCon. She'll be coming here to New York to participate in a KGB reading with, Nobody really interesting. Some guy named Delaney. Actually, Raj Khanna, who's going to be reading here next week, will be hosting that. And it's about five people, and it's all a celebration of 25 years of Clarion West. Now, this I do not understand, because unless I'm mistaken, Clarion West began in 1974.
I'm nodding in that I don't know.
Okay. And the reason I think it began in 1974 is very simple. In 1972, a producer here at WBAI by the name of Margot Adler created a radio show called Hour of the Wolf. Oh, my God. The error messages coming up on this machine while it is rebooting are appalling. And she began the show in January 72, 5 days a week, and I was her engineer 5 days a week and co-host 2 days a week. And then in 1974, the summer of 1974, Margot went to attend Clarion West. Mm. 1974. So unless I'm mistaken, that's 35 years. I remember because that's how I got this radio show. Because Adler went to Clarion West, and I'm here. And when she came back, she took on another show called Unstuck in Time. And now she does something called All Things Considered or something like
something
that.
Something like that.
It's, yeah. Some morning edition. Actually, she doesn't do any one show. What she is she's the New York bureau chief National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. And her materials feed in to the various news programs on NPR. So that's why I think it's their 35th anniversary. Maybe they just misspoke. At any rate.
It sounds convincing. I'll believe you.
Yeah, that's the next KGB reading, and that is co-run by Matthew Kressel, who will be here next week, so we'll let him talk about it. Why should I give them all this stuff? My reading series will be before that. We'll be on July 7th. And normally we don't do a July reading. In fact, this will be our first. We'd normally be done for the summer. But John Joseph Adams, if you were listening a few weeks ago, John Joseph Adams was here with Genevieve Valentine pushing his book Federations, which is an anthology of not space opera, about vast empires.
Prime did that, right? Prime Books?
Yes.
I think? Yeah.
And it's a wonderful anthology. And he told me that we could have Tempest Bradford and the Genevieve Valentine, who you heard on the air a few weeks ago, and Alan Steele, who is a fine hard science fiction writer. And I said, okay, we'll tack on another month. I'll only get 1 month vacation from the reading series instead of two. That's July 7th. You want more information, go to the website, ourwolf.com, or go to Facebook, where I've been fairly active. Oh, do I have to Twitter now? I ain't going to do it. Maybe while Greg is reading. At any rate, now that computers are semi-rebooted, pardon me while I move this over, we're going to listen to just a little music. Since I've already been blathering away for 15 minutes or so, if I can figure this thing out. And, of course, I'm doing it not wearing my glasses. Okay, so we'll start with genre. Folk. Yeah, see? Oh, it actually worked. What do you want, Greg? Steel Eye Span, Fairport Convention, some child ballads, rebel songs?
Oh, why not Fairport Convention for some fun?
Why not Fairport Convention? Okay, so from my favorite album of theirs, Legion Leaf. What do you think, Renardine?
Sure.
Okay.
Why not?
Fine. Assuming I can get that correct, and we'll be back shortly.
Oh, that's like old red dye. She said, kind sir, be civil. My company forsake.
She had an old yow, and she died in her own park. With a merry ring and with joyful sing, for summer is come today. How happy are the lovers, and the merrier we shall be in the merry morning of day. Oh, where are the young men that now to advance? For summer is come today. Oh, some they are in England, and some they are in France, in the merry morning of
Steel Eye Span with, oh, just, let's see, some reels. And before that, Padstow, which is really a May Day song, but the heck with it. I didn't play it in May, so here we are in June. Oh, you see, now, had I thought, I could have played Rosebud in June, but Greg and I have been getting acquainted during this music, so... What of that? And before that, Fairport Convention with Renardine from Liege and Leaf with Sandy Denny, of course, on vocals. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Gregory A. Wilson, who is an up-and-coming but yet not established writer. Is that fair?
I'd say that's fair to say.
Yeah. And your first book,
yes.
Your first novel is
yes.
out. And Well, he's got the actual copy. I've got the dust jacket here.
So. And the ARC that is, that I was able to send
you.
Oh,
yes. I do have the advanced reader copy with me as well. And the novel is called The Third Sign. And the well-bound, hearty
yes.
edition.
Library editions, bless them.
Yeah, okay. From Gale, G-A-L-E Books.
Yep.
And it's classic fantasy in the Tolkien
yes.
tradition.
Yes.
This is something you make study of.
Yes. In fact, I teach a course in fantasy fiction at St. John's University, where these kinds of things come up. Although not my book, although I've had my student, you should teach your own book, and I'm not going to teach my own book.
That would be awkward.
Yeah, it would be very awkward. And they don't know, I'm very grateful to them that they were really interested, but I said, I really can't do that, for all sorts of reasons. It's the first book of a trilogy, not shockingly, and it's really kind of a tribute. Most of the fantasy I write is not this kind. Most fantasy that I write is not epic. It's not heroic. It's I wouldn't call it urban either, but it's very different, maybe even slipstream,
mm-hmm.
But not necessarily epic. But this series that just oddly happened to be the first one that I broke through with is one that I wanted to write in part in tribute to the people that inspired me when
and
I was growing up reading this stuff. For example, you mentioned Tolkien is the biggest one. And then, you know, people to a degree like Ursula Le Guin in particular, Michael Moorcock to a degree, people who had presented these sort of classic fantasies that involve quests and journeys and, you know, groups of adventurers and all that kind of stuff. Stuff which is, I know, you know, at the present time, not the most trendy, I'm aware of that, but it's the kind of thing which really inspired me.
Oh, it's so pretty commercial. I mean, it may not be trendy, but it is still very much out there.
Definitely. No, that's true. That's true.
And it's not the strange, fantastic worlds of, say, China Mieville, who you don't even realize sometimes what you're reading is fantasy until you get to a
right.
particular point, in especially with his new book, The City and the City.
That's right. And Mieville, who has very little use for Tolkien, or fame,
I know.
He said he has no use for him, but obviously, in part, he's always reacting. It's the inverse, right? He's always reacting to it, and thus he is, you know, in part shadowed by Tolkien, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. And what I think is, when I did my first interview with him, I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, he and I were just talking about how long ago that was.
Yeah.
And I think he's going to be at ReaderCon as well.
Yeah, that's right. I saw that.
Yeah. I went to him because I did my studying on his website where he did a little Tolkien blasting.
Right.
And it sort of came down to the first thing he said is, oh, don't get me wrong. I love Tolkien.
Right.
it's the thing that got me I wouldn't say got him started. I think the problem is that Tolkien's form of fantasy took over
right.
the genre.
Right.
And what I think he dislikes are the so many, how the entire genre became
yep.
Tolkien-esque.
A legion of imitators. It's true. It's clearly true.
Yeah.
And spawned, spawned gaming systems based on it, movies based on it. I mean,
although he's very big on gaming systems, China. He is.
Yeah. But I mean,
a huge games player.
But I mean, you know, that kind
but,
of
yeah.
very specific sort of thing. And yeah, I think that's true. I think.
But what happened is not long into the interview, it was apparent to me that he knows as much about Tolkien as most people I know.
Yeah.
And people I know can speak Elvish.
Yeah.
So
he's a closet expert, let's say, or you know, even
and not that closeted actually. And I think he has gone back on. He's a politician.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's a professional. He stood for election as a socialist.
Yeah,
he
right.
is.
So he can shift a little bit or read the tea leaves a little bit, I see.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I think, you know, some of what he said is justified. I think one of the interesting experiences I've had going through this when I first tried to sell this book One of the reactions that I got from agents and publishers was that this, they said, you know, this is really excellent, but, you know, classic fantasy is oversold. I heard the oversold term repeatedly. And John Helfers, who's the acquisitions editor at Techno, which buys for Five Star, which is the imprint of Gale Cengage, they, you know, John Helfers, when I told him this story, said, well, you know, the reason that this is oversold is because people keep buying it, right? So by definition, it's not that this
it's
is a fading.
It's not oversold, then, is it?
Right. So by definition, it can't be oversold in a way. And I'm, you know, I agree with a lot of what Yevil has to say about the sort of dangers of imitation. I do think that when I said trendy, I think that there is a tendency in fantasy to sort of attack anything which seems even vaguely imitative to such an extent that it becomes, you know, it's almost like you can't have any resonances with anything, or, you know, why haven't you immediately and you simply cannot reinvent the wheel every single time in every respect.
Or the wheel of time, as the case may be.
Exactly. As a good example of that. You can't reinvent it every time if you're actually going to be still within anything that's recognizably genre at all. You know, you can write something utterly different and then it won't be fantasy, you know.
Yeah.
But there has to be, those resonances don't bother me, I think. And, you know, it doesn't bother me to write in this genre, this subgenre or other subgenres. But that was one of the resistances, I think. So, you know, it may be a little bit more trendy at the moment to sort of go against this. But popularly, you're right. I mean, commercially, the success of the Lord of the Rings movies, which were wonderfully done, and all of those things, suggest that there's life in this subgenre yet, I think.
Yeah, I think there is, and yet I can also get tired of it. When I started reading the Robert Jordan series,
yeah,
where
did you bail out? About book five, book 12, book 10?
About four.
Yeah,
about
yeah.
halfway through. Four.
I think it was three for me that I finally said, I can't.
Yeah, I think I was bored.
Yeah,
you know,
I think he might have been bored. There were parts of it, you know, at times.
Yeah, and
which is nothing against him, a wonderful writer, but you know. So.
And an interesting, strange man. I got to interview him as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But I should rebroadcast that at some point. His stuff, it's real page-turners. You know, it's very readable
yep.
and stuff like that. But there comes a point where, you know, it ain't a trilogy. It isn't a long novel that's been split into three parts. It's this never-ending saga.
Yep.
Now it's in a river. Now it's
yep.
in the desert.
Yep.
Now it's
yep.
with this culture. Now it's with that culture. But the characters are the same, and they circle each other,
yep.
and they don't stop. And it's fun until you realize you're getting nowhere.
Yeah, and it becomes a soap opera, really, at that point, which has no end point, no distinct end point.
And even there's no point to a quest without...
That's right, without an end point. And even, you know, even poor Brandon Sanderson announced recently that he has to make his final, you know, he was selected, obviously, to finish the series, and he has to make that into, poor guy, a duology. You know, you can't even finish the series without making it into two books because it's just so enormous. Yeah, I think...
And Brandon has his own... epic to grind.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, the productivity on his part is amazing. I'm actually doing a reading. I'm going out to Seattle next week, and I'm doing a reading at the university bookstore.
Oh, cool.
With a lot of people from, you know, Elizabeth Bishop is before me, and they've had John Kessel will be reading because they have the Locus Awards that same weekend at this high school museum. So,
that should be fun.
It is. I'm looking forward to it. But
yeah.
It's been propagated. The reading has been listed in all these, but they've been really wonderful to me. That bookstore, and they've, you know, listed it everywhere. And so it was also in The Stranger, which is their kind of, I guess, the equivalent of Time Out here in New York, let's say. And they list it as, you know, Gregory Wilson's The Third Sign, which is said to be in the tradition of Robert Jordan, which queens quite probably that it is a thick book. And I was like, well, not really.
That means you're a thick reviewer.
Apparently. Well, no, you know, it was fair enough. You see, you can see that the mindset is out there, big door stopper type stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a justified feeling to a degree in some of these things. So.
Yeah, but I sometimes, you know, I get onto my high horse.
Yeah.
And I think, okay, these commercial writers, they're churning out the requisite trilogy and stuff like that. And then when I actually pick them up because I have the opportunity to interview some of these people. It happened this last LunaCon, where I was going to, for the convention itself, interview Eric Flint,
mm-hmm.
Mercedes Lackey,
mm-hmm.
Dave Freer,
mm-hmm.
you know, three people that put out these long, long series. And before that, I had coincidentally interviewed David Weber.
Okay, sure.
And it's easy to sneer until you start reading it. And then you realize this stuff is addictive. It may not be, you know, philosophically deep, but it's good stuff,
yeah.
And it's well done, and it's addictive, and there's a reason why they're bestsellers.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It's there was a discussion that I saw recently about life is too short for long fantasy novels, and it was one of those, you know, deliberately. This was at Absolute.
That sounds like a ReaderCon.
Right. Exactly. Very much so. And so they posted this, and it, you know, created this huge range of responses, as you might expect. And one of the things that people said, I heard some people say, I will only read long books because I know long books must be good. That's a direct quote. I'm not making that up. And then other people who said, well, I don't have time. You know, I could read.
By the way, everybody listening, yeah. Stay tuned for Simon Locally. He's doing Joyce and Homer.
No, there you go. There, see? Perfect example.
Just thought Reed mentioned it.
That's right. So, and then three, you know, some people say I could read three good short books in the time I read the one long book. You know, I think the story needs to be the length that it needs to be to tell it. The problem comes when you have a story that really doesn't need to be as long as it is. I used to teach, I did college debate myself, and then I coached it for a while before I taught in it. And one of the, you know, they have certain time limits for speeches. And I used to have some people who would tell me, you know, I don't think I can say, you know, everything that I need to say about X topic in 8 minutes. And I said, you know, you're not going to come to a revelation in minute 11 that you didn't get to in minute 7, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, similar. If it takes you, by the time you get to page 700, was it really 701 where everything sort of coalesced for you? Couldn't we have seen this in page 301? So I do recognize both sides of it. I think it needs to be as long as it needs to be to tell it, but having it need to come in, you know, weigh in at a certain, you know, weights to be good. I don't know.
There's also the commercial reality of it is that you can't put a novella in between covers.
Right. That's right. That's right. Although bookstores now, you know, I've heard are pushing for shorter work, including from fantasy. That's a relatively new trend within, I would say, even the last 6 months. But there is a definite push towards paring it down. And that may
probably
not be a bad thing.
Probably because they're competing with electronic books.
Yeah, I
now.
Think so. I think so.
An electronic book, you don't even necessarily know how long it is.
That's right.
How long is that novel? Oh, it's 30K, with or without illustrations.
Right, exactly.
You know,
so. Exactly, yeah. So, which may not be a bad thing if some people are sort of forced to reduce a little bit. So
Yeah. Would be putting... I was going to say putting kindling under them, but...
Yeah, very nice, yes.
But at any rate, it's... And one of my favorite forms... No, my favorite form is the short story,
mm-hmm.
and it's just not commercially viable.
Yeah.
You just cannot make a living at it.
Yeah.
No matter how good you are, Ted Chiang doesn't make money. I don't think.
Right. Not without being able to do a lot of other stuff.
We have
an anthology that we're working on, and I'm pretty excited about, again, with John Helfers, my editor for this book, with a huge list of the intersection of political and fantasy, specifically
Ooh.
Short stories of the politics of fantasy and science fiction. And it started out as I had the idea from World Fantasy Con last year.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Minister Faust. Do you know Minister Faust? I know of him. He's really a wonderful writer that I think is not known as much as he should be. He lives in Edmonton. He was on a panel about genre bending. Elves that are vampires and, you know, things that shouldn't be. And he said to me, I had a chance to interview him later, actually, and he said to me that, you know, on that panel, he said, once you get through the one-liners, and you know, it's about 10 minutes, and then everyone sort of sits around for 45 minutes that's left and say, what are we going to do? And so he decided to drop a couple of bombs in the room, including that Tolkien advocated genocide in one of his books. This is kind of the way the minister is. Yeah? So he drops this idea. I didn't agree with him, but it was an interesting philosophical point, and it engendered a very interesting discussion. But one of the things that somebody said really struck me. They said, one of the audience members said, well, you know, we go to fantasy to escape reality, so why would we want to have these sort of, you know, petty political considerations or sort of even dirty political considerations in our books? And I thought, That seems crazy to me. Why would you, you know, why can't fantasy be directly engaged with political issues that we're dealing with, albeit in a fantastic world? So I came up with this idea for the politics of fantasy, and I pitched it to my editor here, who then took the ball and ran with it. And we have a list with John Kessel, Joe Haldeman, James Patrick Kelly, Nora Jemison, in fact, who's in Altered Fluid,
Yes.
is going to be contributing.
She'll be
to
here
this.
Next week.
So we have her. We're working on maybe getting Barry Malzberg, which would be nice.
Yeah.
So we have.
He'll be here in September.
Okay. and there's just a you know a number of David Anthony Durham who wrote Acacia, which is a wonderful book. So you know we have a very good list that we've put together. We're very excited about all of which are sort of short stories.
Patrick is also going to be Gage.
This is we're working on a publisher now. There's about four or five possibilities. So, we even have.
I'm a huge fan of theme anthologies.
You're going to get them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I said my favorite form is the short story.
Yeah.
And so that means you can't do better than taking a bunch of short stories and saying these have something in common.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And in fact, originally I thought of it as one book, and my editor said, oh, you know, I think this is, why don't we make this into duology, one fantasy, one science fiction? I said, okay, great. Patrick O'Leary has a story that he's going to be putting in. So we have a really good list, and we're very excited about it, and I'm hoping that will be timely enough, that it will be, that it'll all sort of work out because of the heightened interest in politics and obviously the interest in speculative fiction, that it will end up being somehow, you know, commercially viable. That's the hope. But it's not easy, it's true, to produce it, and the novel is kind of the gold standard for some kind of success. So we'll see. But I'm excited.
So we don't even have an estimated publication.
No. I know. Yeah. In fact,
but we know that you'll be back here.
Yes, I hope so.
If I'm here, you'll be here.
Okay,
so
great. That's great.
Yeah. That's a guarantee.
Okay, that's so, great.
And maybe if it's going to take a year and a half, we can do a reading.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's great.
That would be way cool. But also, if you're going to do political science fiction, political fantasy, what better place, what other science fiction radio show would you go to than the one on WBAI?
Which is, you know, before and after politics, is surrounded by politics.
Although there is another in New York, so I shouldn't be that glib. There's Howard Margolis out in
Stony
Brook.
But don't be so modest. This is you know, here you have the island of fantasy literature within the, you know.
Yeah, but I always have to be careful. I can't say, well, we're the only one.
Right.
No, we're not.
Yeah. The only 2-hour one, though.
Yes.
So.
It's the longest and the oldest in the world.
There you go.
So.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was struck by that when I had heard of the show. As I told you this off air, I've heard of the show before, but I looked at the list of names and I was just stunned. We originally booked this when I still had my classes still in April. So school was still in session, and I told my students in my fantasy class, you know, half of the people that you've read, he's interviewed every one of these people, and they were all, oh, that's great. When's the show? 5 a.m. I said, oh, well, we'll catch the archive later on then, Dr. Wilson. I was like, that's good. That's good.
Got an iPhone?
That's right. Got an iPhone. There you go.
So, yeah.
But yeah.
You can hear it later.
Yeah. So, I think the short story, I think it can be viable if it's put together in the right way,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of marketed and constructed and, you know, combined in the right way. But, you know, it needs to be creatively done, and a novel is much easier from the beginning to say, here, you know, here it is. Just you know, edit it and package it and then produce it. That's easier than to
right.
sort of deal with the more unwieldiness from the publisher's point of view of the short story.
And often from the writer's point of view.
Yeah.
One of my favorite questions for people, especially when I did online interviews for Ellen Datlow at Omni Magazine and then at a short-lived website she had called Event Horizon.
Okay.
I was one of her interviewers. I was Ed Bryant and I, which I'm real proud of, to be in the same circle as Ed Bryant.
Right.
And I would ask the same question, which drove Ellen up the wall, but I ain't apologizing because I thought it was a cool idea. And she still doesn't, so we argue about this, she and I. Idea that I would ask each and every writer, what form do you prefer, the short story or the long, and why? And some people would give craft answers.
Mm-hmm.
The short story is a little nugget that you polish.
Yep.
And other people would give commercial answers saying, well, you just can't make a living writing short stories.
Mm-hmm.
I would never prompt whether it was a commercial question or an artistic question, an academic question.
Right. Just off the top of my head, as you were saying that, thought of two representatives who would have taken exactly those positions that you just said.
Mm-hmm.
One on the craft side, one on the commercial side.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
And one of the reasons why sooner or later I will do this, but I have so many things that I say sooner or later I will do this. One of the things that I would like to do is go through all of those interviews and ones I've done on the air.
Yeah.
And take that one question that I've asked.
Yeah.
And have everybody's response to the one question.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be really interesting to see. Because it's a meditation, really, not just on form, but on what you're trying to accomplish within your work.
And on the business.
And on the business, and sure. But, you know, from a craft perspective, are you trying to build a world? Are you trying to express the world that is in your head, which is where I think a lot of fantasy writers come from? Or are you really in service to the story? And I know that James Patrick Kelly has told me that the short story gives him the opportunity to really be a storyteller, not a world builder, but a storyteller. If you ask somebody like Pat Rothfuss, who wrote The Name of the Wind, he would say, I have no doubt that he would say that for him it was about, you know, presenting this world, this spectacularly detailed world that he had invented, and that would be more important to him. And if you ask Michael Stackpole, he'd say it's whatever sells books. So,
yeah.
You know, so it really depends. But I find that sort of discussion fascinating. I'm more drawn myself to the novel, I think.
I was about to ask.
Yeah, I am more drawn to the novel, not because of the world-building reason, though, because my stories... my arc takes longer, I think. Although I am going to be contributing, again, assuming this anthology gets off the ground, a short story to each of those anthologies, the science fiction, the fantasy. But generally, I'm more drawn towards the novel, I think, because what you can do with the characters, how you can develop the ideas within them, just is more, unless you're going to do a linked series of short stories, and probably the best example of this is iRobot, where he creates, Asimov creates an arc, and yet... You know, obviously each of these things started out as these individual stories that were just about robots, and then he ties them together with Susan Calvin and so forth.
Yeah, I was just thinking you have that, then you have, like, City by Clifford Simak.
Yep, yep.
Which is actually a novel, but each
yep.
segment is an individual short story. And then you have the Mosaic novel, like Rick Bowes has been writing and is moving
yep.
away from, where there's this weave, this grand weave
yep.
of things going on where you don't see how all the wonderful little interconnections are happening until you read all the stories.
That's right, yep. And then it starts to actually come together. And there's
yeah.
been, there have been experiments with that. Even there's a book, Hopscotch, that sort of was almost like a literary version of Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would go from section to section, and it forced you to turn out of order within the pages of the book, and therefore required you to sort of, you know, piece together in a puzzle, these different individual parts, which I thought was interesting too. But, you know, for the most part, for me, the narrative arc just takes longer to do, and I have, have these people that I need to say more about, as it happens, than I can do within the course of a short story. Although, what readers pick up on, I mean, I had a reader who loves, one of the races in my book is the Arlek, who's kind of a large, bull-headed, I guess a minotaurish creature, but with a whole tribal culture and everything. And he said, you should just write short stories about them. And I said, well, you know, just by themselves? Like, yeah, I love them. They were great. I just want to hear more about them. And, I mean, that's how we get spinoffs, I guess, right? And I said, well, I appreciate that race particularly grabbed you, too.
Yeah, although you can try what Le Guin does in The Left Hand of Darkness,
mm-hmm.
and you can tell your big novel, and then all of a sudden insert a fable or a short story. And actually, in a way, Susanna Clarke does this as well
right.
in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by having these incredibly long footnotes and marginalia
yep.
that are short story length, a lot of them.
Right, yep.
Neil Gaiman does that kind of thing as well.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And that, and Gaiman is a good example of that, I think, who is just sort of masterful at moving back and forth from, you know, one form to the other. Although I've come to the conclusion that I don't think there's much that Gaiman can't do as a writer if he chose to.
By the way, for those listening, if you want to read, want to start with Gaiman, American Gods is my recommendation.
Yep, and it's interesting. I loved the craft of American Gods. I wasn't drawn to the book as a reader as much, which I was surprised by. I loved the Graveyard book, which I actually read to my 17-month-old. Mm-hmm. I love the Graveyard book, and there's an example too in the Graveyard book of something with these sort of interconnected stories telling the story of one, you know, main character throughout. So, but his Gaiman's range is really extraordinary. I mean, what he can do with any form at any time is really amazing. So, but yeah, American Gods is a good place to start with him. I agree.
Yeah. So, since we are coming on to 6, and you said you could read anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes, mm-hmm. which would you rather? Because we can talk more. If you're going to read for 40 minutes, we're running out of time.
Okay. or 35, I mean, you know, somewhere in there.
Well, like it's up to you. It's up to you. It's author's choice. But if you were to read less, we can talk more and take calls. If you read more, they each have their advantages. I wouldn't urge either.
I mean, I guess we can.
And this won't be your only time on the show. So.
Right. I guess I can start reading, and then I guess we'll see where it goes, and I can even stop a little early if need be. So I can split the baby a little bit and maybe do, 25 or something like that.
Okay. Do you want to take a music break first?
Sure.
And then we will be back about 3 minutes. So everybody out there, stay tuned. Well, it's this damned computer. It just, the player just ain't happening. Let me see if I can bring up that song in a different player. That could work. And if it does, fine. And if not, I'll go to the other machine because I do want to take a brief break. But with all these mishaps going on, it's WBAI in New York.
On the Firefly platform on Sunny Good Street, a violent hash smoker shook a chocolate machine, involved in an eating scene, smashing into neon streets in their stoneness, smearing their eyes on the crazy color goddess, listening to sounds of Mingus, mellow, fantastic. My, they sigh. My, they sigh. In dollhouse rooms with colored lights swinging, strange music boxes sadly tinkling, drinking the sun, shining all around you. My, this side. My, this side. Thank you. The magician, he sparkles in satin and velvet. You gaze at his splendor with eyes you've not used yet. I tell you his name is love, love, love. My, this eye. My, this eye.
Sunny Goodge Street, Donovan. I like that song. It's about as beat as one can get in music. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Today is the 20th of June, as Simon would say, in the year 9, and it's about 6 a.m. Of course, you're probably... Well, not probably, but you could very well be listening to this later through an archive or stream or something like that. So if you want to know what time it is, look at a watch. But here in New York, at the live broadcast, it's about 6. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Gregory A. Wilson, with his new novel, The Third Sign. And as you can tell, just somebody with really a finger on the pulse of fantasy, one would say, and what goes into it, which is my favorite topic very often, because... The meaning of fantasy, the importance of fantasy, the important, you know, which, you know, all beginning with mythology and fairy tales yep. are much of what makes the world work.
Yep. Well, we are, you know, we shape our reality based on the fantasy that we wish to see. And
yeah.
so, you know, it's one of the reasons that I get frustrated with people who think that, again, as I said before, this is escapism. And they said, you know, the only reason we live our lives in the realistic ways we do is I hope to accomplish what we have imagined in our fantasies. And so, you know, that's
nicely put.
I went to a conference called Fantasy Matters at the University of Minnesota a couple of years ago, where Neil Gaiman was the guest of honor, by the way.
Minnesota, like it.
And Jack Sipes was the guy who was doing it. And that's why Neil Gaiman came, because he loves Jack Sipes.
Yeah.
And it was a really compelling discussion of why this matters. And we who are in the field know why it matters. And I teach courses in it, and I write in it, and I edit it. And, you know, so I know why it's important. But, you know, sometimes for people on the outside, this is not – you can't reduce it to sort of – caricature or, you know, nerdism or that. It's much, much more important than that. And I am happy that more people may be starting to recognize that with things like Harry Potter. I know it's commercial, but hey, look, she got people waiting in line outside bookstores, things I've been trying to do in my classes for 10 years.
I don't know how to say this to people,
you know?
But Harry Potter is fun reading.
It is.
It's good stuff.
And it is transfer. And it is something that allows people who start reading that stuff, you know, if they wait in line for this,
although
the way
I will
they
say some of those
games,
books are too long.
Oh, agreed, especially
they
later
need
ones.
An editor.
I agree, especially later on in the series they got that way. But you know, the point is, if
but
you
they
can
start
wait
out,
line
they're wonderful.
That's right, and if you can wait, get kids to wait in line for that at midnight in bookstores the way they would for video games. Hey, more power to you. So
yeah, and she's done a lot for literacy in this world.
No question, and so. So people like her have allowed people like me and people like other writers to have a whole new generation of readers that's coming up, and I think they recognize how important
yeah.
it is. So
yeah.
May that be the case for everybody, right?
So having said that, you're going to read for us?
Yes. I'm going to read two things. One thing I'm sure I'll get through. The other thing I may have to cut short depending on time. I'm going to read first the prologue, which is shocking, I'm sure, and then I'm going to read a little bit from Chapter 3. In Chapter 3, a character is introduced called Belezian Drolnar, who is a merchant who has his finger on the pulse of politics in the city Clun Ilar in which he lives. I read him in part because he's a little bit different from what you may get in the prologue, so you might get a sense of what's going on in the book. But first, the prologue. Torek Ilmon, the most recent member of a farmer's bloodline stretching back centuries, perhaps even before the dreamer's first dream, wiped beads of sweat from his brow before bending again to drive his hoe into the earth. It was late summer, and already hints of the oncoming fall were in the air, but hot work was hot, regardless of the season. The harvest had been particularly good this year, good as any that even Torek's grandfather could remember, but that did little to alleviate his workload. Reaping the fruitfulness of the earth had left many wounds, and the soil had to be worked, turned, and coaxed back to its natural aerated condition if it was to yield similar results next spring. This was tiring, tedious work for most, but for Torek it represented a kind of spiritual ritual, a bonding with the land he needed to experience each year to feel he was fulfilling the promise of his heritage. Land was meant to be tilled, dug, shoveled, filtered. It was meant to be used and cared for so that it could be used again, and Torek felt the weight of that responsibility keenly. All the Ilmones did. He was perhaps not the most creative thinker, or possessed of the most ambitious, quick mind, but he was committed to his work, and difficult to sway from a path he had set for himself. Pulling back on the hoe handle again, Torek stood the implement in the earth as he straightened, sighing with the effort. He looked over his field, almost resurfaced now from his work with the hoe, and beyond it to the borders of the wood that lay to the east of the Ilmone farm. Trag's Claw Wood was the official name of the forest, but despite the rumors, it seldom produced anything more dramatic than a wandering bear. Unnatural creatures were few, and unexpected events even fewer. Torek liked it that way, as did his neighbors. Their lives were founded upon regular, predictable cycles, and their existence depended upon careful planning and the application of age-old wisdom. Successions, disasters, and wars certainly happened beyond the borders of his homeland, informally known as the Fields by its residents, but such occurrences made little impact upon its inhabitants. They were content to live as they had for centuries, and it had indeed been centuries since anyone had bothered to interfere with that simple life. Torek grunted with satisfaction as he leaned on his hoe, looking around the borders of his land. Far to the south lay the hills which ran between Trag's Claw Wood to the east and the southernmost area of Razorwood to the west, and even farther to the north were the major cities of the nation of Clun. But Torek, as ever, was most interested in his own space. In his grandfather's time, the field had barely extended to 10 acres, but now it was nearly double that, one of the largest farms in the area and expanding every year. He employed a group of laborers to help him with the upkeep, of course, but they had already been sent home. Torek wanted time to work the land alone, and the unusually good harvest had given him the luxury to indulge himself. This was the time he loved, a few hours of silent thought and careful tending of his ancestral ground. Torek smiled and shook himself out of his late afternoon reverie. He didn't want to waste the remaining light. Bending again to his work, he drove his hoe into the earth. And then, quite suddenly, the air changed. A stillness fell across the land. The wind sank to a sigh, and the atmosphere seemed to close around Torek, who looked up with a frown. The weathermaster in the next village had told him there was not likely to be rain for at least another week, but they were notoriously inaccurate in their predictions. And even when they were right, and the one Torek had consulted was known for his precision, other weathermasters could generate rain at inopportune times when paid enough by jealous rival farmers. Still, such an occurrence had not happened for several years, and he could think of no reason for a weather call to be made now. He sniffed the air and caught a faint acrid scent, unusual for any normal storm. After a moment he returned to his work, hoping to at least finish the field he was working on before the rain arrived. But only a few seconds passed before a low moan echoed across the fields. Torek looked up sharply. The sound was fairly loud without prior warning to have heralded it, and seemed relatively close by. Perhaps a bear had stepped on the wrong end of a stick, Torek reasoned, but just as he was about to accept the logical answer and focus his attention back on the earth, the moaning came again, more loudly this time and closer. It seemed to come from Trag's Claw Wood, and Torek squinted in that direction. He saw nothing but the fences at the end of his land and the trees beyond. But the stillness seemed to grow more oppressive with every passing minute, and there were no clouds visible in the afternoon sky. The moaning sounded again, louder and with a different timbre. Torek thought he heard some kind of a yowling or screeching like a cat whose late-night caterwauls were silenced by a thrown rock or rival feline. Inadvertently, he shivered. This was no storm, and there was no animal he knew that made such an unearthly sound. Dropping his hoe, he ran to his nearby cart and pulled out his scythe. It was hardly a weapon of war, but its blade was sharp, and he had killed a wolf with it one winter several years ago. But that wolf had been young, and Torek had not been alone then. He had no idea what he was facing this time. In truth, he had little wish to investigate the noise himself, but he was alone and had no time to run for others. And despite all his imaginings, the sound likely had a simple explanation, as sounds always did. Why give his neighbors the idea that he was imagining things? Gripping the scythe firmly, he ran towards the forest. Torek was no coward, but as he approached the edge of Tragsclaw, his steps slowed. The wood was not the darkest of forests, nor the densest, but today it felt different, ominous, imposing, heavy. With every step he took, the air seemed to grow closer and more difficult to breathe. After a while, he felt as if he were slogging through mud, so syrupy had the atmosphere become. Pausing at the forest's edge, the scythe's handle damp from his sweat, he peered cautiously into the greenery. He saw nothing but the trees standing silent guard on the forest border, scrubs and moss at their feet. But beyond its unnatural stillness, something struck him as wrong about the forest, though he could not put his finger on what it was. His nose and throat stung with the acrid tang of the air. He was so focused upon the unnatural atmosphere that he had entirely forgotten about what had drawn him to the forest in the first place, the sound. Suddenly the moan echoed again, but this time it seemed to be nearly on top of him, and far louder, and now he clearly heard that it was more than a moan. It sounded like several creatures screaming or yelping at once, but, and this he could not understand, they seemed to be both opposed and combined in some way, like some kind of bizarre chorus of discontent. He froze and looked around slowly. Nothing stirred. And he suddenly realized what had eluded his notice before. He saw no living movement at all. No birds flew, no squirrel stirred, no fox darted from tree to tree. He bent down to the ground and dug experimentally. No insects could be seen in the earth, neither worm nor beetle. The land around him seemed utterly, entirely devoid of life. Torek shook his head and turned away from the woods. Strange as it might seem to his neighbors, something was clearly wrong, and he would rather be labeled a coward than a fool. He headed back towards his cart, but he felt as if he were walking through sand. It was now very difficult to breathe fully, and the air felt as if it were trying to crush his body into the earth. His mind swam, and his eyes darted from side to side. He had the odd feeling he was waiting for something. All at once a great moaning and screeching arose, seemingly all around him, the most terrible noise Torek had ever heard. Screaming and howling came from the forest, but not as isolated noises. Rather, they made up a noise together, one sound of painful torment. As Torek dropped to his knees in terror, he heard for several seconds what he swore were voices, human voices, shrieking in the most wrenching agony he could have imagined. He struggled to rise, but all energy and strength had deserted him, and his brain seemed unable to command his legs to move again. His breath came in labored gasps. As he turned his head to look back at the woods, he caught a glimpse of swirling colors and odd shapes, and then, with one more deafening scream of agony, it burst out of the forest and was upon him. The soul wall ravaged north, and there had never been any sound more horrible than that of its passing, now joined by one more unreasoning, hideously distorted shout of agony, as if ripped from the lungs of a still-living man. Chapter 3. Drawing his black cloak close against the biting rain, Belezian Drolnar hurried down the nearly deserted city street, and, not for the first time, cursed his bad fortune. It had been bad enough when Duke Alarion had imposed a curfew on an all-too-willing populace, nervous from the increasingly dire news arriving from outside Clunillar, cutting down city traffic and distractions for the night watch as he did so. Now this latest patch of bad weather made it almost inconceivable that anyone would have a good reason to be out this late. But Drolnar did have a good reason, just not one he could share with a typical city guardsman. Far too many questions would result, and he had no time for any of them. The wind whipped the bottom of the cloak around his ankles painfully as he walked, and Drolnar stifled the urge to rip the damned thing off. Without it, he'd be soaked to the skin, or at least more soaked than he was at the moment, and would stand out even more than he feared he already did. He knew his way around the streets of Clunillar as well as anyone, and was used to changing routes as necessity demanded. But he was no rogue or assassin, and the merchant garb beneath his cloak was as noticeable as a campfire in the wilderness on a clear evening. As he reached the corner of the main market street, the familiar clank of metal sent him scurrying into a small alcove, his cloak drawn tightly around him. A moment later, two guardsmen appeared, armed with halberds and short swords that hung at their belts, one carrying a hooded lantern that swung back and forth in the wind. As they rounded the corner, the other stopped and put a hand on his companion's shoulder, wiping his face with his other hand. "Why they don't want to issue full gear is beyond me," remarked the guard who had first stopped. Wet whiskers plastered on his face made him look vaguely like a waterlogged rat. "Without visors, we can barely see 10 feet in front of us, and I don't know how they expect people to fight when they're drenched."
"I've heard the treasury's running low. They don't have much left to get gear out to those who need it," said his somewhat shorter and clean-shaven companion. Most of the full gear's out to the Arliks at the border, from what I hear. And the pay, too, I reckon. We'll be the last to get restocked, mark me. The other man snorted. If they're saving their coin for the Arliks, they're wasting their money, he said, removing one cloth glove and trying vainly to shake some of the moisture out of it. From what I've heard, they aren't likely to stay at their post much longer, no matter how much gold you throw at them, and there's no way of knowing when they'll decide to give up the whole business and leave. You better hope you're wrong, Revith, the other said, or you'll have a lot more than being wet to worry about. What do you think'll happen if they do leave? You've heard the rumors, same as I have, and you know the other side's been building up forces a lot more powerful than the captain's willing to tell us. Who's going to stop them if the Arliks let them through? Huh, Revis spat, who, having wrung out one glove, was now squeezing the other. Whoever'll stop them later can't be worse than what we've got now. It's not like the border's been impossible to get over at least the past 5 years. More than one's gotten through, and a few of them, I hear, he said as he looked at the other man meaningfully, might be given the orders up top even now. "Shut your mouth," the other whispered urgently, looking around him nervously. "That's traitor talk, and you know it. Besides, you don't have proof. The captain's been at his post the past 10 years and sounds the same now as he ever did."
"Sounds the same, aye," Revif said, undeterred. "But that don't mean he is the same. You remember that Marlowe, 3rd Regiment? Friend of mine said he sounded like the same old Marlowe till one day he murdered half his company in their sleep. And they never found him, neither. He just sort of vanished, my friend said." Who knows where he got to, or who or what he really was? And even if the captain is just the same, he's got someone he answers to himself. And whoever that is could be given the orders he wants, if you follow me.
Pah, you're being a fool, the other man scoffed. The city's got its own people to look after that sort of thing, and it's done it for a long time. So Marlowe lost his grip one night. That don't mean he was one of them. And even if you're right, you want more of them coming through? I don't much see you standing up to a bunch of shapeshifters or worse any more than I see you getting promoted to captain any time soon. The Arliks now, they've been willing to do it, and they've beat him before, too.
I might be a fool, Solitna, Revif retorted, pulling his glove back on with a frown, but at least I see what's around me. If the Arliks leave their borders, and they will leave it, mark me, you'd best be ready to stand and fight if need be, because the enemy'll hit Clunillar first. And if this city falls, you'll need a lot more than Arliks to stop the storm that blows up next. And if we do have to fight, I'd rather it be with full gear than with this peasant wear.
He punctuated this last remark with a hearty shake, like a wet dog trying to dry its fur. "Have it your way, Revif," Solitna replied. "But as for me, I'm a guardsman, not a border soldier, and I'd rather the Arliks worry about the border than us. In the meantime, we've still got streets to patrol and a report to make, and we're late as is. If there is to be pay, I'd like to be around to get it."
"Aye, all right," Revif said reluctantly. "Not much chance of getting dry, anyway."
The pair moved off down the street, still talking, and turned another corner at its end. Drolnar allowed himself a wry smile as he left the alcove and continued the opposite direction. Guardsmen weren't known for their intelligence, but these oafs were a lot closer to the truth than they knew. But only part of the truth. In the end, they had more to worry about than a few shapeshifters and others from the enemy getting through the border. Finding out how much more, in fact, was his purpose this evening. Drolnar quickened his pace as he heard the bell from the town center ring 10 times. He had no wish to be late for his appointment. Those he worked with were not particularly forgiving of lateness, or anything else, from what he could tell, and their meeting was scheduled for 10 minutes past the hour. 2 more streets passed before Drolnar turned right onto a narrow lane. Counting the buildings as he went, he soon began to pass a series of squat, ugly homes. He wrinkled his nose in disgust from the stench, like a combination of rat droppings and blood, he thought with a shudder, and hurried on. He had no idea why the meeting had to take place in this part of the city, an area he came to as little as possible. But he was not in a position to ask questions. Yet, he reminded himself grimly. After another minute, he stopped in front of an unremarkable wooden door on his left and peered down the street in both directions. Other than a rat scurrying behind a barrel, the lane appeared deserted. Satisfied, he leaned over and whispered into the keyhole. A few moments passed, during which time Drolnar wondered a bit nervously if he had miscounted the houses, before the door opened a crack. Dim light streamed out from within.
"His coming's known to us," a harsh and guttural voice growled from inside.
"Our knowledge is our strength," Drolnar replied promptly. Another moment passed before the door opened wider.
"Enter and be quick," said the voice, and Drolnar wasted no time.
He was relieved to be out of the rain, and the warmth was welcome, but otherwise this was hardly the most comfortable of meeting rooms. 3 hard wooden chairs waited near the fireplace, all unoccupied, and a cheerless fire flickered in the hearth behind them. Another door was on the far wall, and 1 closed and shuttered window was set in the wall next to the front entrance. A small wooden table sat against the opposite end of the room, upon which a rusty lantern and 3 rough wooden mugs rested. Drolnar started as the door closed behind him with a rather loud bang.
"You're late,"
the voice said as a lock clicked, and he turned to see who was speaking. Drolnar regretted his decision to look almost as soon as he had done so, for the voice was mild compared to the appearance of its owner. He was of medium height, and wore a rough woolen cloak, unhooded, with a scarred and burned leather tunic that had clearly been through more than one conflict. A short sword and a pitted leather sheath hung at his side. But far more noticeable was the face, scarred, burned, blue-black in color, with one eye socket entirely closed, and not well, by what looked like a simple flap of skin. The other eye, brown and cold, glared at Drolnar with malice and cunning. A huge scar ran from the edge of his mouth to the dirty brown hair that fell about the man's skull like weeds. All in all, Drolnar thought he was looking at quite possibly the most ugly and disturbing face he had ever encountered, and Drolnar's profession ensured that he had seen thousands of examples of ugliness in his time. But his profession had also trained him in the art of deception on the highest scale, and he had long ago learned not to betray his feelings openly. So he buried his disgust and looked at him calmly. "I came as quickly as I could," he said, "but this is not the easiest part of the city to find or get to. And I had some work to do to avoid the patrols as well. This would all have been easier if we could have met at the place I suggested first." The other man spat as he walked to the table. "Aye, in the middle of the merchant district, where there are more guards than merchants," he said, taking one of the mugs, "and where you could lay an ambush for me and my lads with your mercenary scum if you wanted more money out of the deal. No, we want no part of your places, self-thief." He chuckled before taking a long drink of whatever the mug held. Drolnar's mouth tightened, and he inadvertently gripped his fist underneath his cloak, as much for the term self-thief as for how close the other man had come to the truth of Drolnar's thoughts. But he quickly regained control and smiled grimly. "You're much too suspicious, friend," he replied. "In the merchant district, my guards are paid by me, not the city. And they get paid enough to keep their mouths shut about whatever they happen to see, or they get their mouths shut for them, permanently." "You hardly think," he continued pleasantly, though with the subtlest edge of iron underneath, "that you and your people are the first ones I've dealt with from outside the city. I know more about foreigners than you do, I'll wager, and I understand how to deal with them. If you follow me," he finished with the quiet of a blade being loosened from its sheath. The other man lowered his mug and looked at Drolnar through his one good eye. "And I know how to deal with a fat cut-purse who gets above himself, self-thief." He moved his hand down to the hint of his short sword almost casually. "We're not friends and won't be. I don't have to buy mine." As Drolnar looked back at the other man's scarred face, he smiled and shrugged off the insult, though inwardly he added the man to his list of those he would deal with when he had the chance. "Your own choice. I meant no offense. But we have business to conduct, and the hour is late. I have much to do. We should get started. And I don't deal with shadows," he added, as the other man moved his hand away from his sword. "I need a name to you, since you already know mine." "It's not hard to know your name, with you shouting it at anyone you think will remember it, Belezian Drolnar," the other man sneered. "And I'm the one calling the shots here, not you. But since you'll hear it away anyway soon enough, most people call me Rix. That's good enough for you." He leaned against the wall near the table and took another long drink. "As for getting started, that'll happen when we're all here, and not before." "As you wish," Drolnar replied smoothly, though inwardly his stomach tightened a bit. He had known he would be dealing with more than one person, but he'd hoped for a single contact within the city. More people meant more variables, and he hated variables he couldn't influence. Drolnar had built his success on knowledge: who sold what, who controlled what trade routes, who could be bought, sold, and eliminated. The city should have moved against his circle of contacts years ago, and would have if Drolnar were not aware of nearly every tryst, double deal, and sordid activity of the city's officials. The Duke himself had more than one skeleton in his closet, though Drolnar had to be careful not to overuse that knowledge. Illyrian was concerned about his public image, but more concerned with his own power, and he had his own network of spies and informants, only a couple of whom were actually on Drolnar's payroll. It was a dangerous game, but one with rich rewards, and Drolnar had played it to perfection for almost 10 years. During that time, more than one pretender aspiring to political and economic power had appeared on the scene, but almost always proved to be nothing more than a puppet backed by a local guild house, or sometimes just a fresh-faced young merchant with delusions of grandeur, and both kinds were easily dealt with. The last such pretender had done fairly well for himself, actually, until he went too far by wanting to put Drolnar's network out of business. He was soon found in the south quarter in an alley behind a local inn, his throat horribly torn out and his mouth full of coins. Things had quieted down considerably since then. Still, Drolnar could never afford to be overconfident. His power was based entirely on who and what he knew and when he knew it. When he had gotten wind of a new power rising in the city, he had been inclined to dismiss it as a series of drunken hallucinations. Even he couldn't afford to track down every dead-end story. But the rumors persisted, and other signs began to appear. Disappearance of usually reliable contacts, reduction of normal commerce, protracted silences from the city's other merchant leaders. And of course there was the political situation outside the city, the problem with the Arleks and the threat of war. A general climate of unease had descended upon Clun-Ilar, and that was bad for both business and political maneuvering. So Drolnar had taken it upon himself to track down the meaning behind the disturbances, and determine both what threat it posed and how he could turn that threat to his advantage. Weeks had passed before he had turned up any leads at all beyond the usual rumors and vague mutterings of a few tavern locals. He had begun to despair of discovering anything significant about the matter until it had, so to speak, sought him out. 5 days ago, on the evening Drolnar was supposed to have met one of his most reliable contacts in one of his counting houses, the merchant was startled out of his musings on the problem by a cry on the street outside, suddenly cut short. By the time Drolnar had reached the Tor, his two guards, both city guardsmen by profession, though in fact on his payroll, had arrived from their posts and were crouched over a body on the street, an arrow protruding from its back. As Drolnar ordered the two to circle the perimeter of the house looking for the assailant, he himself was always protected by more than just guardsmen, he noticed a small note attached to the arrow, which was in the fresh corpse of his unfortunate informant, and unfolded it. "Call off your dogs, merchant, or we'll bring them to heel ourselves," the note began. "If you want to know who we are and why we're here, be at the meeting in 5 days. If not, stay clear, or the next arrow lodges in your heart." Crude directions followed along with a password for entry. Drolnar had not reacted visibly, but his mind raced with a mixture of admiration for the group's work and anger at the position in which he found himself, uncertain for the first time in an age as to what to do next. Certainly he could not ignore the threat, as there were few in the city who could attack his operatives with impunity, and he was sure anonymity. He doubted his guards would find any sign of the attacker. This message had been sent by a professional, and professionals covered their tracks. The loss of the informant was inconvenient, to be sure. Creating reliable and loyal contacts was not an easy thing, but contacts were replaceable in time, and Drolnar had been threatened more times than he could remember by groups considerably more dangerous than an assassin in the shadows. He was not concerned about his own safety. What was most troubling was that he had somehow been connected to the search, given the care with which he conducted his investigations, highly unusual, and that meant that for the first time someone had as much or more information than he did. After hearing the reports of his unsuccessful guards and ordering them to dispose of the body quietly, Drolnar had resolved to close the information gap quickly. And here he was 5 days later, with little more information now than when he had started. Still, he had a name, Rix, and a face to put it with, and that was itself an advantage. Patience, he reminded himself, would reveal the rest. A whispered hiss suddenly emanated from the front door's keyhole, and the man, who called himself Rix, pushed himself away from the wall and silently set his mug on the table. Drawing his sword, he moved quietly over to the door, and after a short pause, cracked it open, peering through the narrow slit. "His coming is known to us," he whispered. A deep and rattling voice replied, "Our knowledge is our strength." Rix sheathed his sword and opened the door wide as it could go, in fact, for the creature that entered needed every inch to squeeze through. Drolnar's eyes widened as the huge being, at least 8 feet tall and as solid as an ox, made its way through the opening into the house. It was covered in a sopping wet black cloak, like Drolnar's, the size of 3 of them, in fact, though as the creature removed the garment, the merchant thought he caught a glimpse of an odd symbol inscribed in the cloak's lining. But he barely had time to process the thought, as it was all he could do to keep his mouth from dropping open at what had worn the cloak. The creature was covered in short brown hair that bristled as he brushed the raindrops off, and his lower legs, impossibly rippled with muscles, ended in cloven shoes, iron-shod, and with one wicked iron spike at each shoe's tip. The upper legs and torso were covered in a kind of sturdy, dark brown hide armor carved with a host of strange symbols and runes. The arms were bare and covered in the same coarse brown hair, muscles like iron knitted and relaxed as the creature cleaned itself of the rest of the moisture. But what most amazed Drolnar was the creature's head, massive, covered in hair, and with a protruding bull-like snout. Saber-like teeth extended outside the mouth and onto the sides of the lower jaw, and 2 short but sharp horns emerged from the powerful skull, which ducked low to avoid hitting the ceiling. The eyes, yellow with black pupils, glared out from beneath 2 bristling eyebrows, and Drolnar had the uneasy sense of being examined both inside and out. He had never seen one of these creatures, but he had heard them described many times, sometimes with respect, often with fear, occasionally with admiration. But no description did justice to the truth. Drolnar was unquestionably staring at an Arlek.
You've been listening to segments, prologue and most of Chapter 3, from The Third Sign, read for you by the author, Gregory A. Wilson, here over WBAI New York. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. That was, of course, Steel Eye Span with Thomas the Rhymer. Music by Steel Eye Span. Lyrics by, do you know, Greg?
That I don't know.
Ah, film by the name of Tolkien.
Oh, really?
John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, at least translation.
Oh, okay.
By, I mean, okay. Obviously, Thomas the Rhymer predates
right. Yeah,
Tolkien
exactly.
And
exactly.
Everybody else, but that actual now is it a translation or version? I guess that version put together, probably taken from Middle English or
slightly
older, more recent than Middle, but middle-aged English,
right?
Probably.
Okay, very cool. I didn't know the
Tolkien.
So
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, he's credited with the song.
Oh, great.
So. I always get a kick out of mentioning that.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. Yeah.
The program, by the way, let me mention to people, is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I can't talk. Our guest this morning, Greg Wilson. And I was looking, by the way, on Facebook, noting a couple of people tuning in. It's sort of neat.
Yeah, that's
to do
good.
That,
that's cool.
You know, and Twitter away and actually see a couple of people going, oh, I'm listening to this.
That's good.
That's very bizarre. It's
interactivity in the internet age.
Yeah, although as I point out, you know, we can always just take phone calls.
True.
Which is the same thing. And, by the way, if you'd like to do that, the telephone number here at WBAI to speak to Greg Wilson is 212-209-2900. And as always, the idea is be on topic. So we'll take calls in a minute. When is the second book? I assume you've sold the
book. No, I have not yet. Nope. In fact, kind of an odd thing that's happened is that Five Star, which has a long history of publishing good fantasy, David Neil Wilson, who wrote a blurb for this for me, Jim Hines, who wrote, you know, The Goblin Quest and The Stepsister Scheme is his latest series, he went from Five Star to DAW. And I'm going to have to end up doing something like that because Five Star after this year is getting out of the fantasy business.
Oh my.
Yeah. And it's a very unfortunate because everyone around it associated with it, including my editor, is like, what? But we have all this great stuff that's built up. So I'm going to be looking for a larger house, and I'm in the process of doing that. I have another novel completed. I have a sequel to this that I'm working on too. And so that stuff is out there with some possibilities, you know, as well as that anthology I mentioned. So I've got some stuff on my plate, but currently the second book is not bought yet. So
okay, but reading this, I don't think it'll be a big problem, and we'll see how sales do on this.
Yeah,
but we should mention again, hey, just out.
that's right.
The official publication date was the 17th?
June 17th, yeah.
Okay, so
available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Five Star directly. If you go to my website, which is gregoryawilson.com, I have links to all of that. So.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what folks should do. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, gentlemen.
It never fails. Good morning, Robert.
It's your phone, Jim, not mine.
Now, I'm telling you, five calls coming in, Robert, five calls coming in at that moment. I choose one at random. It's always bleeping you.
Oh,
not that I object.
I'm sorry. Well, anyway.
You're certainly
there's more
sorry.
There's more things important to discuss than that. Mr. Wilson, that was the best. Dr. Wilson. That was the best cliffhanger I have ever encountered in Arlick. I would like to be a proverbial fly on the wall and be just out of range of an Arlick encampment and hear one of their storytelling swaps.
Yeah, and you would definitely not want to be one at the end of their acts. They're designed to be fast and graceful enough, despite their strength, to maybe get at a fly. So
8 foot tall, they sound very agile. Okay.
Yep.
Unfortunately, I missed the first 40 minutes. I was up late last night, and so I won't ask you questions that probably Jim asked.
This is late last night.
Yeah, I know. Do you have maps?
Yes.
You have maps.
Oh, yes.
Lovely. Absolutely.
Absolutely,
lovely.
Yes.
It wouldn't be a proper fantasy novel, especially an epic of this sort, if it didn't have a map.
Designed by a friend of mine, in fact.
Do you have appendices, or to use one of Jim's words, marginalia?
No, you know, I don't, and that was not intentionally avoided by me, but I guess it's a good thing so that people don't think, you know, well, really, and do you have something called that rhymes with Silmarillion? Or, you know, I wanted to be, you know, a little bit different, but intentionally. So.
No, but however, it could be that could be done especially if you have a second or third, if, you know,
no
whatever
doubt.
You have at the end of the third or
no
second,
doubt. Yep.
You might have marginalia. Do you have, by the way, this city
you
is...
You see, those would be appendices and not marginalia. Marginalia
footnotes.
As you're reading it.
Yep.
Yeah, footnotes.
Yeah.
Yep.
A classic case of marginalia, and I've just finished rereading it, although I'd read it many years ago, is Michael Crichton's wonderful Eaters of the Dead.
Yep, yep.
And I love what he does with the footnotes, how the marginalia. Now, let me ask this. This world, by the way, this city, if I didn't know it, it sounds like 16th century Venice or any Italian city-state
yes.
that I've ever read about.
Yes, yes.
I mean, this merchant, obviously, and the guilds, and I mean, it just sounds like something that you would... You know, read in a description of a 16th century European city-state. Does your world, in your story, day-to-day life, do we know something about the culinary, about the musical instruments, what kind of music they sing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this a world, is this a gazetteer? Do we have a gazetteer in this book?
yes, to a degree. I am always striving to balance
as I was talking about before, world building with storytelling. And so there are elements that I put in harvest festivals, districts of the city. And each of the cities, the nation is called Clun, and the four major cities, which are Clun Anor, Clun Aerith, Clun Ilar, and Clun Conan in the south, all of those four cities have their own sort of distinct characteristics. On the other hand, a lot of what I know doesn't end up directly in the book because I get frustrated as a reader with having to go through, and we were talking about this with Robert Jordan, it's wonderful how descriptive he is, but do I need to see 5 pages on tapestries, and every thread of the, so I try to balance it. So yes, they exist, and some of it is in there. I hope enough to keep people engaged in the world itself.
Your names totally invented, or do you strive towards some myth-based? I mean, would somebody looking at this, at your name say, aha, he's an expert in, or he's an aficionado in a certain mythos?
I would say no. The names here are invented, although I have a second novel called Icarus, which is a fantasy that's unrelated, which does draw more upon sort of mythical concepts, obviously ancient Greek concepts specifically. But this is invented more or less, although I'm sure there are resonances with myth too.
But I mean, but somebody looking at your names would say, aha, he's into Celtic or he's into whatever.
Probably not, although they would, I would say they would certainly feel, it would probably feel vaguely Anglo-Saxon to them. I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
Because I can't get away from the shadow,
And so. Again, who's the publisher? Again, I missed the first 40 minutes
Gage.
Of this wonderful show.
Right. The publisher is Five Star, which is an imprint of Gale Sengage.
Gale.
Yeah.
G-A-L-E.
Yeah. And again, that stuff is available on my website too.
Yeah. Well, good luck, and I hope Jim does have you for a reading. I mean, this obviously, and I'm going to use a word from Tolkien's book, or the Baird Searles, who did the wonderful Council of Elrond and other things from Tolkien. This world of yours sounds like a singing world. It sounds like an epic world. It sounds like the kind of world that some bard or griot or scald or, Ashik would sit there with his instrument and sing and chant about. And this is the kind of world I love. I chew this stuff up and, just whatever.
Oh, thank you. And I appreciate that. In fact, the world is said
to be... It's a musical world. It really sounds musical.
It is. It's said to be sung into existence, in fact. So you picked up on something that's quite right. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Have a good day.
Thanks,
have a good
you
day.
Too.
Okay, take care. Good morning. And hi there. You're on the radio. Oop, no, it's our weird phone system. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello, turn on your radio, please.
Yeah, Dr. Wilson.
Yes, hi.
Love your stories.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I think Robert said it. It's, the singing. Particularly the first story, is it published?
You mean this first?
This is from a novel called The Third Time.
When it has just been published, indeed, yes.
Yes. Do you come from a farming background?
No, although I have relatives who did, so I spent some time on farms in my youth.
Yeah, I realize that because there are only organic farmers in my background,
mm-hmm.
and you capture or you express what I've been trying to express most of my life.
Good.
Yeah,
I'm glad.
And plus, also your other stories. I mean, the power of the id is still there. It's just very powerful.
Oh, I appreciate
transformed
that.
Transformed in a beautiful way.
Well, thank you very much. I
really,
that.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. And good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi there.
This is about the discussion you had on the short stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're not really mutually exclusive from novels. I guess the best example I would like to bring up would be like Eric Flint's 1632 universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's built like a whole ecology around that with like form teams of other writers.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does he have his novels out, but I think it's like 7 or so books of short stories that have been published.
Yeah, a whole bunch of anthologies that, and he doesn't write, and he shares them. It's what you call a shared universe.
Right, right.
I interviewed him at Lunacon, and oh, was he wonderful.
And once you've established a universe, you don't have to go back and recap everything every time you write a story.
Right.
And
if you do it well, there are those who do to the detriment of their work.
Uh-huh. That's true.
the and another writer who has done that to a lesser extent is David Weber with his Anna Harrington universe.
Mm-hmm.
I think he has something like 4 books out.
11.
No, 4 books of collected short stories.
Oh, yes, yes. Several of which, one may point out, he collaborated on with
right.
Eric Flint.
Yep, yep.
Right. And so you can have your long form and your short form, you know, mutually reinforcing.
Right. I think that's true. Well, you know, the early Thieves World anthologies were much the same way.
Uh-huh.
Where, you know,
by Bob
Aspring.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same kind of thing, uh-huh. where you had these short stories kind of connecting together a world. No, I think that's true.
And
they don't...
George Martin has done that
yep.
with the, now I'm blanking on...
Wild Cards?
Wild Cards.
And right. David Anthony Durham, by the way, is going to be doing a new one in that series. He announced on his blog some time
oh,
ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And Durham is a heck of a writer.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Normally a novelist, though, Durham, so...
This can happen, and you're right, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, certainly Le Guin has Earthsea
sure.
short stories
sure.
and
right.
Earthsea novels,
sure.
Although she has not shared that universe. It's something that can be done, but nevertheless, I would say that the craft of the short story, the craft of Le Guin's, for example, The Rule of Names,
yep.
is so different than Tanu.
Yeah, different muscles. And I would say that normally, if you're going to do what you were suggesting in creating the universe, normally starting with a novel, even if it's not a published one, allows you the scope to open up the world within which then you can tell these short stories. So I think that often the novel then precedes the short story in that regard. Not always, but in a lot of cases it does to kind of give that scope. But I agree, it doesn't have to be an absolute hard and fast distinction, sure.
By the way, was your Icarus published?
No, that is that's the book that I'm actually shopping right now. I'm working on a third book, shopping a second, and vaguely working on the sequel.
Well,
to this,
I,
so.
Well, teaching
thank
and playing
you, and,
music.
I might go with my blessings.
Oh, thank you very much. I
thank you so
it.
Much.
Thank you.
Have a great morning. Mm-hmm. Good calls this morning. Where are the women? It's like I sometimes I have to ask, and usually when I say that, they'll call up. I hope this will be one of those occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And let me inform folk that the telephone number here is 212-209-2900. And good morning, Reggie. What are you? Oh, okay. It looked like a weird patch on your shirt there. I'm sure that all of our listeners noticed that first thing.
Yeah, the very first thing.
Yeah, well, sure. Why not? You come into a room, that's what they would hear, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. And I've distracted myself, but let me just remind people that we have to do it more frequently as we move further into prime time. That this is WBAI New York. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Dr. Gregory A. Wilson, or Greg, if you like.
Yes.
Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
I was profoundly disappointed that they're not.
Oh, dear. I just know from the voice we have an issue there.
Gotcha.
Yes. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First off, really good reading. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
I identify with the Arleks because my name is Alec, and Alex, and my name, and I'm 6'8", so.
Oh, well, then there you go.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Don't have that much muscle, though. But yeah.
I hope you're considerably nicer than this particular Arlek I was describing. Some of the Arleks
oh, no,
are...
no, we didn't get that far.
Well, that's true. That's true.
And you have a villain named Brix. My question is, does he have a dolphin?
not that I know of, no. Rick's not likely to be near the ocean anytime soon. He's city born and bred, I'm afraid.
Well, so was Porter Rick.
Ah, that's true. That's true. That's true.
Anyway, but enjoyable story. Like it a lot.
Get the book.
Yeah, it's Third Sign by some guy named Wilson.
That's the one.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't have anything intelligent to mention after that, except the thing that I was going to mention is that you were talking at some point about languages, and I had mentioned last week about languages. I had a new field of study. You heard of cryptozoology?
Yes,
yes.
Yeah, I was suggesting a new field of study, cryptolinguistics.
Huh.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
It's studying all of the mythical languages. It gets you Elfish and Klingon. And
that's a great idea.
Well, you know, there's a, and I can't remember the place, there is a university where there is a, you can get a degree in languages of that kind, in Klingon, Elvish, and things like that, which I think provides the ultimate "what are you going to do with that" question from the parents. But
you change your name to Lawrence Schimmel.
There, there you go. But there is something out there. So yeah.
Actually, I heard a really good story that would relate to that, but you know, it's not on topic. So no, it's a good story. It's about some guy who went to Japan. He wanted to see the countryside, so he did go out into the countryside, and he went down to the front desk to get directions, which train to take to go out to the countryside. He goes out, he goes and he looks around, and he goes back to the platform, realizes he's gotten back to the platform an hour late. He doesn't know how to get back to Tokyo. So there's some kid, 11-year-old kid, wandering along the platform with a T-shirt on that says, "In Klingon, I speak Klingon." And so he strikes up a conversation, and that's how he got his directions back to Tokyo.
Excellent.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's wonderful.
And that's a universal language for you.
That isn't completely off topic, actually.
No, not at all.
Yeah. But, yeah, cryptolinguistics, there you go.
Excellent.
That's a great idea, actually, and could probably do a book on it.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine once pointed out that so many people are trying to learn Klingon because anyone who spends that much time watching TV is too dumb to learn Vulcan.
There you go.
There you go. Absolutely.
Take care.
Okay. Have a good morning.
Thanks.
Okay. If you were calling, call back. We have a weird phone system here that, you know, only holds the fact that you're calling for like a minute or so, and then it goes away.
Oh.
I'm sorry for that. But we have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
And the number is 212-209-2900. And we'll remind people again, the name of the book is The Third Sign. The author is Gregory A. Wilson, and you should remember all that because that's the website.
Right, GregoryAWilson.com. If you do a search for Wilson and The Third Sign, I think it comes up now. I guess there haven't been too many Wilsons working on third signs that I know of.
Oh, dear. Okay, okay, yeah. So that's, you know. Yeah, although and if you do just Gregory Wilson, you get a plethora of people.
Yes, a magician, an MD, and some guy who might be in jail. So I'm troubled that this is the way my name is. This is why I invent my names, you know, so I don't have to, you know, I live with the most common of names all the time. So.
Very good. So perhaps we might even, at this point, dispense with the calls.
Okay, sure.
But we haven't even discussed your music.
Sure.
And as somebody pointed out, music is very much in the background,
which I really am glad comes through. I'm the lead singer of a progressive and trumpet player of a progressive rock band called The Road. Our second album called Monomyth is going to be coming out within a couple of months. It's ready. The final mix is done; just needs to be mastered. We do progressive rock in the mold of King Crimson and early Genesis and, you know, Yes and all those kind of good bands.
I always liked
Dream Theater, yeah, you know, yeah. Stuff like that. Yeah.
Renaissance. Oh, you mentioned Renaissance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a lot of connection with fantasy work too. It's not surprising in a way. You know,
and each of those bands you mentioned.
There. Yeah, right. Absolutely, sure. You know, I mean, even if you in the Court of the Crimson King, sounds right off like a fantasy novel or an album, but, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been playing with them for, 9 or 10 years. I have very, the guitar player who I started it with, I met at Brandeis, which is where I got my doctorate in Boston. And he is an expert, by the way, in Latin. So, we sometimes get these language discussions that are kind of interesting that don't happen, I think, in maybe punk rock bands. So I've been doing that for a while, and that's really enjoyable. It's somewhat different. There are resonances, but it's somewhat different from my writing, but it's enjoyable. And Monomyth is actually a concept album about a journey, shockingly, so I guess it does all fit together.
Okay, and that's also the portal for all that is through your website again.
Yeah. There are three sections, academic, author, and musician. The musician one has a very pretentious picture of me that was taken by my promo guy. It has nothing to do with me, I promise. And if you click on it, you go to my website directly, and you can listen to the music and buy the CD and all that stuff if you're interested. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually the sample that I heard from the website I liked.
Oh, thank you.
Because I am a fan. I haven't played it on the air a whole lot. Not in recent years, anyway. Mm-hmm. But I used to play a certain amount of that progressive rock.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe I will again soon. I have somewhat eclectic tastes.
Yeah, well, it's progressive. It's coming back.
Okay, good.
It's back in the coming.
Yeah. So we have 2 minutes left. In that time, what should we remind people?
I guess I would remind them that, the book is available. On my website, I have contact information for me and a comment section, which is becoming more used, ever increasingly used, which is wonderful. I also have a schedule of events. I have a reading in Seattle, as I mentioned, the University Bookstore.
Yeah, you should actually give that information because there are people who do listen through the internet and all that, and so this can be heard in the West Coast.
Okay, so that is going to be taking place on Friday, actually a week from yesterday, June 26th at 7 p.m. At the University Bookstore in Seattle, Washington. I think it's on University Way Northeast, and that's the same weekend as I mentioned, I think off air about the Locus Awards. No, I mentioned that on air, so that will be happening then. Then in July, I will have a reading at the Riverdale Library here in New York. Actually, I'll have ReaderCon first, so I have a reading there, and I may be on a panel. I don't think they figured that out yet, but I'll see.
No, I haven't gotten my schedule yet.
They got started a little late this year, I think, because it's some health issues or something.
They get started late every year.
Every year.
Last year, Eric sent out the stuff like 8 days before
I know, he
the
does.
Con.
You know, Eric actually is connected with Sonia Taff, who's won a Risling Award for poetry, and she is a former student of mine at Brandeis.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, when I was a graduate student there. So, ReaderCon. Then I have a reading July 18th at the Riverdale Library. Then I may or may not be at WorldCon, I don't know, in August. Then I will be at Gen Con, where I'll be at a number of panels in mid-August. And then at the end of August, I will have a reading in my hometown in Connecticut. And then I don't know after that. We'll see.
Okay. Well, all very good. But again, if you go to GregoryAWilson.com,
yes,
you will find out all these things.
Indeed,
and
yes,
read the blog and all that good stuff.
Yes, indeed.
And next week on this program, we will have a plethora of guests. Altered Fluid,
yep,
by name, and Rajan Khanna will be reading a story, and the rest of them are going to critique it. And July 4th, something special. Don't know what yet, but something special.
Should be fun.
So, Greg, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
First of
all, it
will be several appearances, no doubt.
Wonderful. I'd like that.
And thank you all out there for listening. Try to stay dry today. It may not be easy, but do that if you can.
Amen.
And stay tuned for Simon Locally with As I Please and a tour of Dublin, I believe, on Dublin and ancient Greece. Is that correct?
Yeah, something like
that. Okay. That should do it. So, again, thanks for listening and take care. Good morning.
Remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.